Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Today's podcast is titled The Morality of Capitalism. Recorded in 2007, Dennis McQuestion, former clinical professor of corporate governance and executive director of the Institute for Excellence in Corporate Governance at the University of Dallas at Texas, Tibor McCann, Hoover Institution Research Fellow, Professor Emeritus of Philosophy at Auburn University, Professor of Business Ethics at Chapman University, and co-founder of Reason Magazine, and Tom Palmer, Senior Fellow at the Cato Institute, discuss the morality of capitalism. We hope you enjoy today's episode, and don't forget to subscribe to the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
The subject of today's program is the morality of capitalism, and we'll define both morality and capitalism. But more importantly, you'll hear some thoughts about the morality of capitalism you have not heard anywhere else. Let's get to it. First on my right, Tom Palmer is a senior fellow at the Cato Institute, which is based in Washington, D.C. His primary areas of interest are political science and how societies move from less free to more free. Tom, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Dennis.
And sitting next to you is Tibor McCann. He's a Hoover Institution Research Fellow, Professor Emeritus of Philosophy at Auburn, and Professor of Business Ethics at Chapman University out in the West Coast. He's also a very prolific writer and a co-founder of Reason Magazine. Tibor, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Dennis.
Why are we talking about the morality of capitalism? Tell us what that means, anyway.
Well, political economic systems like socialism, capitalism, the welfare state, fascism, and some others, they all compete for moral legitimacy. They would like to be the best sort of system under which human beings can live in peace and cooperate with each other. And so the question of which one has a greater claim to moral legitimacy is an important one. Socialists definitely think that theirs is a morally superior system to those of, say, capitalism or the welfare state. People who support the welfare state think that theirs is. So those who support capitalism also make a case for the morality of their system. Now, what does that mean? Morality is the system of ideas that answers to the question, how should one live? How ought one to conduct oneself? The answer to that, usually they come in sort of a theory, a system like utilitarianism or egoism or hedonism or altruism. Those isms are the proposed answers to the question, how one ought to live. And the morality of capitalism is then whether capitalism as a political economic order accords well with the answer to the question, how one ought to live.
Does it?
Well, I would argue yes, it does.
Because?
Because under capitalism, more than any other system, human beings are free to make choices. And the primary prerequisite for morality is freedom of choice. If you cannot choose how to live, if you can't choose your actions, your conduct, your institutions, your relationships, and so on, then you are not in a position of showing that you are living right or wrong. You are not a free agent. Without free agency, there is no morality. Capitalism is the one political economic order that secures this free agency better than any other. Under socialism, for example, people are lumped together as groups, as natural groups, so that their individual choices don't matter. It's what the society decides, or the public, or the community decides. Under fascism, it's some leader who makes decisions for everybody. Under communism, it's an automatically good system so that there is no choice anymore. Only capitalism recognizes the unique human attribute of free choice in the guidance of one's life. And so, basically, with all of its problems, because capitalism is not a utopia, it does have its liabilities, but with all of its problems, it is still the one that accords with human morality better than any other.
Well, that, and all that sounds great in theory. However, Tom, from an economist standpoint, I mean, most people would say that, you know, capitalism provides a lot of goods, a lot of services, a lot of products, makes a lot of people wealthy, and yet leaves a lot of people behind. So what's moral about some people doing well and other people not doing so well?
I look at things a little bit differently from Tibor's. I think they're complementary perspectives, but a different angle from the perspective of a political scientist. One of the things that you found was that societies that are officially committed to a kind of egalitarianism, everyone's going to be equal, not like under the free market before the law, but equal in the amount of stuff that they have, that actually generates highly unequal societies. Socialism is a self-defeating system. The ideal is everyone will be equal. But what happens? To achieve that, some people are given enormous power over the entire society. And big surprise, turns out everyone is equal, but some are more equal than others. This was George Orwell's great insight, was that that kind of system was self-defeating. That there's a moral claim that can be addressed on its own terms. Should everyone have the same amount of beans? Should everyone be equal in every regard? But it turns out when you empower someone to create that system, you will create new kinds of inequality that are far worse from the perspective of the concern for human equality than anything generated under capitalism. As a simple example, Bill Gates is much richer than I am. I cannot imagine the amount of money he could put to work with his own life. But the difference between the medical care he enjoys and what a relatively poor person in America enjoys is not nearly as great as the difference between party members and non-party members under the Soviet Union.
Yeah, under the Soviet Union or China today, even as that goes. Winston Churchill said this. He said, "The inherent vice of capitalism is the unequal sharing of the blessings. The inherent blessing of socialism is the equal sharing of misery." Tibor, you sort of grew up in a very difficult situation. Tell that viewer where you grew up and how you managed to get out of an environment that may be a little different from what the one you live in today is.
Well, I grew up in Hungary. I was born on the eve of the Second World War, and when I was around 8 years old, the Hungarian government turned communist. That is, communist in the Soviet sense. No country has ever been communist in the sense in which Marx meant communism, because a communist society doesn't even have a government. So this is communism as interpreted by the Soviet Union, which is really a form of fascism under Stalin or Brezhnev or whoever. And as such, it is a totalitarian system where all of your life is under the jurisdiction of those who are in charge. Now, that doesn't mean that there is no pockets of liberty here and there. There's even massive black markets, because frankly, they are just too inept to really be totalitarian the way they would like to be. But the intent is there. And if they manage to spot you as doing something that is against the will of the rulers, you're going to have sent off to labor camps, you're going to be killed, you're going to be put right. As my mother used to tell me when I used to talk out loud, the walls have ears. Everything is watched. Everything is supervised. You are not a free agent by any means. Now, the communists have a way of rationalizing this because they believe that human beings are not individuals. We are parts of like a body, like your cells and limbs and organs are parts of you, according to the communist ideologues. People are not individuals. They must coordinate with everybody else. That's what their dream is. And so in order to approximate something like that, the commissars, the leaders, basically coerce everyone to follow the same thing. The best image of this is indeed what we see when we see North Koreans march around, all looking the same way, all behaving the same way. People don't know that actually their pajamas have different qualities of cloth in it, but that's hidden from view. The fact is that in that kind of a system, you don't have any of your own goals you can pursue. And that is one reason that that system collapses eventually. Because if you don't have the individual initiative that addresses problems at the local level based on the various facts that you are aware of, based on resources that you can control, which is impossible under that kind of a system, If you don't have that, then the society stagnates and eventually falls apart.
Okay, so economically it stagnates and falls apart. We've seen that in the former Soviet Union. We've seen it in China before 25 years ago, before what they started doing now is a more capitalistic
right.
approach. And yet, Tom, you know, there's still this issue, though. You know, capitalism is a system in which virtually all private property is privately owned. There are a lot of people, you mentioned Bill Gates, Warren Buffett as an example, who's just given a ton of money to Bill Gates' foundation, $30 billion or whatever it is. And yet there are those people who are left behind. It may be for due to no fault of their own. It may be because they're totally incompetent. Maybe because they're mentally unfit for some reason or the other. I mean, how moral is it if you have a group of underclass that just can't seem to compete in a capitalistic system?
Well, the key thing is to look at the facts and data. And the fact is that free market societies are more equal than societies that have unfree markets or that have state control. There's more equality. And that the people who do the absolute best are the people on the bottom of the heap. But that seems a little striking because people don't like the idea of a heap. But the fact is that poor people, and take the United States or Canada, two fundamentally capitalistic nations, poor people in our countries are so much wealthier than rich people in countries that do not enjoy the benefits of the market, even than the wealthy there. So I reject the fundamental premise that there are people left behind in some sense. Yes, Bill Gates left me behind, but it doesn't mean I have a blighted or terrible life. I come from a family where we were of modest means, not college educated as a background and so on. I went on to college. We were able to do have good, rich, flourishing lives, even though we came from fairly simple background. That's the experience of immigrants who come to the U.S. People who are on the bottom of the heap, stomped on by their ruling classes in their home countries, they come to this country, they're treated as equals before the law, they flourish, they form their own businesses where they can manage their own lives. So I reject the premise, to begin with, that some people are left behind in the sense of experiencing absolute poverty. That's simply not the case. And if you look at the economic data, the fact of the matter is, understood in absolute terms, there are no poor people in the United States. There are people who are less wealthy than others. But when you have even poor people in this country have air conditioning. Go to a lot of other countries where wealthy people don't have air conditioning and hot climates.
Or even electricity in some
electricity,
cases.
Cell phones, having a car. In fact, it's quite striking. Even taking the wealthy countries of Western Europe, Olaf Gesemann, a German economist, did a simple and quite striking comparison. People in the lowest quintile, the lowest 20% of income in the United States, have more access to housing space, automobiles, air conditioning and a number of other goods than people who earn the median income in Western Europe. Well, that's really quite striking. So the fact is that capitalism is an enormous machine for eradicating poverty and for enriching the entire population.
How important to the concept of capitalism is incentives?
I think it's important not only to capitalism, but any social system incentives. Socialism gets all the incentives wrong. That's one of the reasons why I think it doesn't work. The incentives are all wrong. The question is to get the right incentives. And for that, you need private property rights. They have to have the three Ds. They have to be definable, so I can know what's yours and what's mine, on the basis of which we can be good neighbors. They have to be defendable, that is to say, a functioning legal system in which if I were to trespass against you, you could get some legal recourse in the law, not a blood feud or get out the shotgun, but a legal recourse. And they have to be divestible, that is to say that you could sell them, transfer them, give them away on the market. So unlike feudalism, where you can't transfer it outside of your family. One of the problems with countries that are struggling economically is that they don't have those three things. Socialism has collapsed in some countries, but they don't have well-defined property rights. They don't have a functioning system of law. Capitalism isn't just an economic system. It's fundamentally a legal system, a system of law that governs our relationships.
What about China today? I mean, China, I've just gotten back from China 90 days ago, and it appears that they have been able to maintain what they would consider to be the best of all worlds, an authoritarian government, but a capitalistic market system of some type that enables them to significantly increase the well-being of at least a portion of their population, maybe more than the bigger portion.
China is one of the most exciting places on the planet right now. It is in a rapid process of transformation, and that is legal, political, and economic. The one that is the most visible to us is the economic transformation. But as they are growing a middle class, it will be more difficult for their authoritarian rulers to maintain their power and their monopoly on power. As people become wealthier and educated, they start to say, how come I have to take orders? Why can't I be involved in decision-making? And democracy becomes more attractive. This is what happened in the case of South Korea. They had a military dictatorship. They did some things right. They had substantial foreign trade, basic capitalistic system, and that got rid of the military dictatorship. It was successful because capitalism brings about a social and political transformation towards democracy, towards the rule of law. It's sometimes uneven and unpredictable, but it is the only way, the only way to generate a democratic political culture is by having a fundamentally capitalistic market-based system.
John, I want to get back to a little bit to this equality thing because it also ignores human nature. The fact is that the kind of egalitarianism that so many political theorists prefer requires coercive interference with people's lives. The fact is that most individuals make choices, and out of those choices, results emerge that will not be the same as their neighbor's results. And that's a form of inequality that cannot be remedied, if you even call it a remedy. I actually dispute the notion that this ideal of universal equality is a good thing. I mean, think about it. Is it a good thing for all of us to look alike, to dress alike, to sound alike, to be that much alike? It's not. Indeed, individuality, diversity, makes for human existence. It makes human existence unique. We're not all like those same ducks or the same pigeons. We are different. In fact, it's a kind of an interesting dichotomy amongst critics of capitalism, because on the one hand, many of them are multiculturalists, so at the collective level, they endorse diversity, they embrace it, they champion it, but on the other hand, they are also egalitarian, so that they would erase all the differences. What kind of a moral philosophy is that that lands you in such contradictions? I think the crucial aspect of morality is that from a public or legal point of view, that people have the chance to flourish at their pace, according to their judgment, as best as it's possible. And then if there is some discrepancy, if there is something to worry about, they voluntarily straighten things out. Friends, family, associates, people who work with each other, they work on this rather than have the heavy hand of government come in, not only because government gets corrupted in the process, but their very goal of equalizing everything is a perverse goal in human life.
All right, well, let me put, let's just give to your argument, say that capitalism, one of the major things that argues for capitalism is not just the economic benefits, which you've alluded to here, which I think even most of us watching this program would know that that's the case with capitalism, but the issue of morality is important because if, in fact, we still have I don't guess we've ever had a purely capitalistic system.
No, we
never
don't.
Have,
we don't.
And never will have. But where are we on the spectrum from, let's just say, a capitalistic state to a fascist or communist state? We seem to be somewhere in the welfare state
That's right.
So,
we're a welfare
so
state.
What does the fact that we are a welfare state in many ways mean in terms of morality?
It means that some people's mistakes are dumped on the backs of other people. And some people's accomplishments are not left for them to decide what to do with. Notice how Bill Gates, billionaire, even under the welfare state, he's got this wonderful opportunity to decide what happens to much of his wealth. This is the greatness of capitalism. It's not greed that justifies private property rights. What justifies property rights is that you get to decide what happens to the fruits of your labor and your labor in that. You decide whether you want to devote this to some cause of the environment or the arts or to your friends or indeed your own artistic development. That is what's so wonderful about capitalism. Not that it always ends up with the perfect distribution of wealth. Sometimes there are poor people, but some of those poor people are indeed poor by choice, and some of them are not. But in a capitalist society, you have this chance of people finding out how to live their kind of life more than in any other society. Not perfectly, but more than in any other. And almost, I mean, there is no other way to judge political economic systems other than comparatively. It's very dangerous to build some sort of an ideal in your head, like a perfect circle, and then try to adjust things to it. The perfect is the enemy of the good, you know? And a good system is good in comparison to the other ones who are not so good, and some of them are really bad.
Yeah. Now, Tom, from a capitalist standpoint, and the welfare state that we're in right now, what are the dangers, if any, to the continued intrusion of more and more government, more and more taxes, more and more programs, more and more redistribution, and of course more and more debt, deficits, and everything else, not to mention the trillions of dollars of unfunded liabilities and the social programs in this country?
I think the problem is that it generates social conflict, and you mentioned the question of unfunded liabilities. The current social security system in the United States is basically a generational war that is slowly starting to happen. The reason is that it's basically a Ponzi scheme. It's a pyramid scheme or a chain letter. These are the same things. If you or I started a system, we'd go to prison for fraud. The federal government manages exactly such a system. It requires you have an ever-expanding base of the pyramid. It's what's called a pay-as-you-go system. But we are not having an ever-expanding base of the pyramid. We're reaching a point where the ratio of workers paying taxes to retirees is shrinking quite rapidly. It was 37 to 1 when the system was started. Well, not hard to sustain. It's going to go down to about 3 to 1. Well, that is going to be more difficult because there's no investment. There's no wealth that's been created. It's just a transfer system. You can think about the repercussions of welfare systems throughout the society. People who are going to make rational choices should think about these issues. If my medical care is going to be paid for by the state might have some influence on how I'm going to live. And a perfect example is the helmet laws. If you want to wear a helmet when you're riding a motorcycle or not, in my opinion, that's your business. It's your head, right? You ride and enjoy the freedom of the highways at your own risk. However, if as a taxpayer I have to pay for maintaining you if you get in an accident, you don't do it through your own private insurance, well, suddenly I have a big interest in making sure you wear a helmet. And this has come up over and over again as a justification for restrictions on your behavior. Now, also, I may have an interest in the diet that you consume, the food that you have, how you lead your life. The reason is, when all of these decisions are socialized over the whole society, I bear the consequences of your choices. That means I have an interest in how you choose, and I'm going to exercise that influence.
And you're going to exercise that influence through elected politicians of both parties who are going to put their finger to the wind and say, where is the political wind blowing?
Or just bureaucrats who now are able to exercise power over your life. So I think that the welfare state is in a state of tension with personal responsibility and personal freedom. Those are the two things that go together, responsibility and freedom.
This is a publication from October 30th, 1936. You mentioned Social Security, and it's addressed to employees of industrial and business establishments. And it talks about the Social Security law, which was passed in 1935, and it's going to give 26 million working people something to live on when they're old and have stopped working. That's what it says. I'm going to read you just a couple of things from it. And it says, first of all, that the checks will come to you as a right. You will get them regardless of the amount of property or income you may have. They're what the law calls old age benefits under the Social Security Act. Blah, blah, blah. That it comes to you as a right. But the part I want you to particularly, and I want you to particularly pay attention to, is this. The taxes called for this law will be paid by both you and your employer. And of course, we all know that the taxes are all paid by the individual, even though they're collected from different places. For the next 3 years, you'll pay maybe 15 cents a week, maybe 25 cents a week, maybe 30 cents or more. And it goes on to say that after that, you and your employer will pay a half a cent more for 3 years. And finally, beginning in 1949, 12 years from now, you and your employer will each pay 3 cents on the dollar that you earn up to $3,000 a year. So 3 cents of $3,000 is about $90 a year. And it says here, I love this, this is the most you will ever pay. Last I checked, that hadn't exactly been the most we've ever paid.
No.
So how much longer can we sustain this and still call our society capitalistic and still be moral about what we're doing when a lot of old folks like me and Tibor are going to have to be supported by you in the future?
Well, thank you for complimenting me on the age. It's not actually such a big difference between us.
I'm crushed.
I don't think it's a catastrophe that some people have mentioned, but it is a serious issue. Young people are going to be terribly burdened. It's only a few years from now when the cash flow will go negative. That is to say, the outflow will be greater than the income from taxes. We're told, don't worry, we'll go to the trust fund. There is no trust fund. This is actually dishonest on the part of politicians. We were lied to. The trust fund is a piece of paper. It's an IOU kept in a file drawer in West Virginia. I kid you not. It says, I owe you so many trillions of dollars. The only way to fund the deficit, the difference between the outgo and the income, is by either raising taxes or cutting other government expenditures. That's the same as if there were no trust fund.
Yeah, which means there's not a trust fund. Now, we're about out of time on this segment. I'm going to give you the last 15 seconds here, Tibor. I want you to tell us what is moral about a society that is passed on tax expenses to the future generations.
Oh, there's nothing moral about that. It's disgusting. It completely divorces responsible conduct from consequences. The whole welfare state, it mixes up individual moral responsibility for one's life and makes out of individuals not friends and civilized associates, but enemies.
But enemies. Thank you very much for joining us. And thank you because, you know, your future and that of your children is tied to how this subject is viewed, not only now, but by later generations. The world looks at America as a role model on economic issues. And if we cannot fail them, I think if we do fail them, it'll be bad for them, much less bad for our future Americans. So thanks for inviting us in to talk about things that really matter with people who really care.
Want more episodes like this? Don't forget to subscribe and get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.